Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. John Blaxland makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him briefly. He's a senior fellow in at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University in Canberra, and a former director of Joint Intelligence Operations at Headquarters Joint Operations Command. He is the author of the second volume in the official history of ASIO, which ran from 1963 to 1975, titled The Protest Years. His writings on Asia-Pacific security affairs include The Australian Army from Whitlam to Howard, Strategic Cousins, and as editor, East Timor Intervention. And tonight, John Blackman is going to talk to us on the occasion of the publication of his latest book, which is the third in the official history of ASIO, The Secret Cold War, 1975 to 1989, which has just been released. So I welcome our speaker to talk on Australia's Secret Cold War. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. It's a great pleasure and a privilege for me to be here with you this evening. And I hope that what we're going to talk about tonight is going to be quite revealing interesting for everybody concerned. This is actually the third volume of a complex project that was initiated a number of years ago, and ANU won the contract, and Professor David Horner was the project lead. I was hired as the second historian, second author, to accompany him on that project, and the principal research assistant, Dr. Rhys Crawley, came along, and he's in co-authored volume three. As it turned out, we actually we're only planning initially to write two volumes, but we found we had so much material, and we talked ASIO into going past the mid-1970s and go to the end of the Cold War. And that justified going for a third volume, and we were tight for time and having a massive data to go through. And Dr. Rhys Crawley agreed to help me write the third volume, and that's what's happened. We had also a fantastic advisory committee with Dr. Jeff Gallup, the late Mr. Jim Carlton, and the Director General of Security, successive Directors General of Security, finally with Duncan Lewis, and the Deputy Director General as well. And so what we had was a very interesting project Okay. So volume one, which is the one that Professor David Horner wrote, was about the origins of ASIO as the fourth arm of defence. The idea was that Australia had a security service, but it was really not seen as competent and capable, and was really seen as not up to the job that was emerging as the Cold War emerged. Sir Charles Spry was actually the second head of the organisation after Justice Reid, was appointed in 1949. He was in for a 12-month period, Sir Robert Menzies appointed Charles Spry. Of course, the highlight of Volume 1 is the defection of Vladimir and Evdokia Petrov and the Royal Commission of Espionage, which generated so much controversy in the mid-1950s. And the work that ASIO was doing in countering espionage, countering what it saw as subversion, and protective security. So this multifaceted mandate it had to protect the nation as the fourth arm of defence. And that volume won the Prime Minister's Literary Award, it won the St Ermin's Hotel Intelligence Award. It really was a significant body of work under Professor David Horner. And I was very privileged to be asked to write volume two, Volume 2 covered the protest years. That's the years from 1963 to 1975, so the Vietnam War protest years and the years of Gough Whitlam. And, of course, that was a very significant, turbulent time, the crash period of Gough, that saw ASIO going through a very turbulent period, challenged enormously. Really not having much luck with the slides here. This is the time when Lionel Murphy was the Attorney General. Early on in the tenure, he conducts a raid on ASIO, very controversial raid on ASIO that sees him lampooned in cartoons. And obviously the relationship between Gough and Lionel Murphy wasn't great, and this was exacerbated during that period as well. But we see there significant issues that are below the surface in terms of Croatian extremist behaviour and Lionel Murphy seeing ASIO as not to be trusted. And what he finds is that, in fact, it really was doing what it said it was doing and being fairly upfront. But for so long, ASIO had been under the guidance of the Liberals, the Conservatives, and it was not seen as something that the Labor Party could trust, particularly after the Royal Commission of Espionage. And so the scepticism was palpable in that period. And in this is when Gough Whitlam basically commissions Justice Robert Marsden Hope to conduct a Royal Commission on intelligence and security in 1974, but that doesn't materialise until the period covered in Volume 3. And, of course, Volume 3 is the period we're talking about tonight, the secret Cold War. This was supposed to be the period of detente. We're all supposed to be more peace, love and understanding. The Chinese had established diplomatic relations with Australia. They had a diplomatic presence in Australia. The Soviet presence grew. And I'm having no luck with these slides, am I? Would you mind? Yeah, thank you. That would be great.
Do you want the next one?
Yes, please. The next one. Yeah. There we are. So you see there with the third one covering the Fraser years and the Hawke years. And this is we're talking about significant reform about the politics of ASIO. As counter-subversion morphs into counter-terrorism. Protective security remains a key part of the domain that ASIO is concerned with. And countering espionage is full on. It's still very much in going on. Next, please. It's actually just next to that gentleman's head, sorry. So, next again, please. Yeah. So we see Justice Hope, Robert Marsden Hope, is commissioned to undertake two Royal Commissions and the Protective Security Review during this period from 75 to 89. The first one, 74 to 77, the Protective Security Review after the Hilton Hotel bombing in 78 into 79, and then the second Royal Commission on Australia's Security Intelligence Agencies from 1983 to 1984. Next, please. And he conducts, as you can see, a whole pile of reports there. Next, please. Extraordinary amount of writing. Malcolm Fraser, who's Prime Minister, who takes over from Whitlam in November 1975, as we know, controversially. He didn't commission Hope to do the Royal Commission, to undertake the Royal Commission, but he was very supportive of Hope's work, surprisingly enough, and of course also of Whitlam's selection, his choice for a Director General, Sir Edward Woodward, and that works out quite well. Next, please. Justice Woodward, as I say, he does a great job following on. He's the first justice since Justice Reid in 1949, and Whitlam sees that as a very significant factor in selecting a Director General who's from the law, and that works quite well in the case of Edward Woodward. But he actually doesn't think that his successor needs to come from the law, and that's what we see happening thereafter. Next, please. So just quickly on countering subversion and politically motivated violence. Next, please. We see there that ASIO conducted surveillance on prominent Australians with Soviet or revolutionary connections. And I particularly like this cartoon. I gave a lecture at the Manning Clark Theatre at ANU, and it's the great Tanberg cartoon, history by Manning Clark, and then the ASIO officer behind him, a history of Manning Clark, which... It tickles my fancy anyway. Next, please. Now, what we saw, though, is this whole issue of countering subversion. In the old days, it was very clear the Communist Party of Australia was Soviet-funded, It was espousing revolution. But after the 56 Hungarian suppression and then the 1968 crushing of the Prague Spring, we see the Communist Party really, the wind's taken out of its sails. And we see a splintering of the communist, the socialist revolutionary left, with the creation of the Socialist Party of Australia, Soviet-funded, the Communist Party of Australia, Marxist-Leninist, Chinese-funded, and a variety of Trotskyist and various other splinter groups. And ASU plants people inside these groups. One of them is Lisa Walter, who is very young, impressionable, and is in a very intensive set of circumstances with this Trotskyist group. And she's turned by the Trotskyists. She went public, revealing names of ASIO officers, because Edward Woodward, the Justice, the Director General, thought it was appropriate that ASIO officers not hide their real names and use cover names. Of course, that policy was subsequently rescinded because of the problems generated here. Next, please. Stephen Ricks, this is the key case that was argued at the Security Appeals Tribunal, established after the First Royal Commission in the mid to late 1970s. And the Security Appeals Tribunal argued in 1983 that Communist Party of Australia membership was inadequate grounds for denial of APS employment. That's because by this stage, the rhetoric and the official lines coming out of the Communist Party of Australia, which is no longer Soviet-funded, it's actually becoming more and more focused on actually trying to win elections, which it does terribly badly at. But Ricks's case goes to the Security Appeals Tribunal, and it is it's a inflection point because it made ASIO rethink its priorities, and the CPA really drops away. Now the other fringe groups remain of concern, but not so much. Next, please. Who would have thought this would be so difficult?
The Communist Party said it.
Yeah. So moving on to consider countering terrorism. Next, please. Now, this is something that there are a number of instances shown throughout the book in the late 1970s through to the 80s. But the most significant one, of course, is the Hilton Hotel bombing of 1978. This is where we see two garbage workers killed, a police officer killed and another wounded, and several bystanders injured as well. Now, the Ananda Marga quickly emerges as the principal group believed to be behind the explosion. And Hope, Justice Hope, who just completed the First Royal Commission, is tasked to conduct the protective security review. What we see emerge from this is interagency counter-terrorism coordination is boosted, but there's a real problem there between the police and ASIO, because the police is looking for evidence to take someone to court to get them locked up, and ASIO is looking for intelligence that is about not necessarily to take to court, and the cultures actually clash and they don't mix very well. And we have, of course, the enduring saga that emerges after the hotel bombing. Next, please. Now we see the Hakoa Club bombing the Westfield Towers bombing in 1982, with groups associated with the cause of Palestinian liberation as the principal suspects, but not actually taken to court and prosecuted to conviction during this period. So it's a very murky period as well. Next, please. Another one, this Armenian Revolutionary Federation member, Hagop Levonian, was killed instantly when a bomb he was carrying exploded in the basement of the building housing the Turkish consulate in November 1986. So we're seeing more of that. Yes, next, please, Anne. And you see in this next photo the damage done to the Turkish Consulate General office in Melbourne in November 86. This is at the time that ASIO is relocating to Canberra, by the way. So the fact that ASIO manages this during this period is very indicative of how ASIO is really refining its procedures, rising to the occasion. And you see there, so just to put this counter-subversion, we saw counter-subversion featuring quite prominently in the 50s and 60s through to the early 70s. We're seeing, though, with this surge of bombing and identity-related extremism, the shift in emphasis in the terminology to counter-terrorism. But interestingly enough, you know, writers have focused on surveillance conducted on Australian citizens, and there are many books out there on Australians who have been under surveillance by ASIO. But interestingly enough, what we've found in writing the history of ASIO is that the majority of ASIO's efforts were actually on countering espionage, which is what they're established for in the first place. And I particularly like this cartoon because it really does give you a sense of the, that kind of frustration of many who actually aspire to be famous, at least partly famous, because of their ASIO files, and to find that you don't have one, of course, is very disappointing. Next, please. So, next, please. Countering espionage. So what I wanted to do is what we see is show you some of the technology in use. Now, it's a little bit Maxwell Smart-like because, you know, ASIO was at the cutting edge of technology, really, at the time, in terms of the equipment that was available for them to use, miniature cameras, the stuff that in hindsight looks fairly simple, but at the time was cutting edge and very significant. Next, please. So that was a camera. Then you see some more of the bag, a concealed camera, radio transmitter and receiver, next please, in a lady's shoulder bag from the late 1970s. And this is a listening post with several hidden microphones connected to these banks of recorders that are attached to some a residence where people who were directly targeted under warrant from the Attorney General were actually being monitored closely. Next, please. An example here of a receiver recorder from around 1986. Next, please. And one of the portable dry photocopiers proved convenient for operations. Now, there's a couple of stories in the book about operations that ASIO conducts where they actually get access to buildings and conduct some photographing of material and do this at the in the wee hours of the morning and get out quickly. And it's high drama, if you like. It's quite nail-biting. It was certainly nail-biting for me working on it and conducting interviews on some of the people involved. Very interesting. And, of course, that technology nowadays seems fairly rudimentary, but at the time was quite cutting-edge. Next, please. Now, the other thing is that ASIO, as I mentioned, was very much focused on countering espionage. And so ASIO monitored the construction of additional premises that were happening, particularly in the late 70s and into the 80s, because the expansion of the footprint of Soviet and Soviet bloc embassies were quite significant in the mid to late 1970s. So you see this one from 1976. ASIO sought to capitalise on opportunities that presented. And, of course, the main focus throughout this period was the Soviets. And this is an aerial view of the Soviet embassy in Canberra on Canberra Avenue. It's interesting because Soviet embassy and staff were ASIO's top operational and resource priority. And this is an aerial shot. You can see they're obviously spending quite a lot of resources monitoring this place quite closely. And there are a number of stories in the book about ASIO's attempt to track and engage and hopefully co-opt members of the Soviet embassy and not so successful for a variety of reasons, some of which I'll touch on shortly as we get through the story. Next, please. A Vietnamese diplomatic residence in South Canberra. This is a classic example of a popular surveillance target in the suburbs of Canberra. ASIO officers across the road conducting photographic and eavesdropping surveillance. Next, please. The Chinese prison. Now, this is a very interesting one because the Chinese came along and they established themselves in an old motel in Watson on the northern suburbs of Canberra, and they had this old hotel, motel, ringed by high fence with open paddocks. It was a very difficult place for ASIO to place under surveillance, and there's some interesting story of guys in the bathroom of a building nearby, tippy-toes, trying to reach over and, it's quite amusing in hindsight. But, of course, what we see is the Chinese have a very different approach to espionage to the Soviet Union, and the Soviets' approach is very much based on the resident, the KGB resident, operating out of the embassy and operating with dead letter drops and so on. The Chinese model is quite different, and that presents quite a challenge to ASIO. Next, please. Now, this is a photo of the Yugoslav embassy in Canberra, the operation against the Yugoslavian intelligence service gave ASIO confidence in its judgment about the work of the Yugoslav intelligence services. Very successful operation, the details of which are still very sensitive, but it was very successful and it gave them great confidence about in the judgments they were making about the Yugoslavs. Not so much with the Russians, but on the Yugoslav target, very, very confident. Next, please. Now, of course, the most significant event, if you like, that was publicly on the stage, on the TV screens around Australia, was the Kum Ivanov affair. Next, please. And Valery Ivanov and his family, he was identified as a KGB officer. This is photographed in a shopping centre in Canberra. Next, please. His house was placed under surveillance. His house was under warrant, and a number of listening devices were installed in his house, including in the chandeliers. And it was really, his house was complete. It was very hard not to be monitored inside his house. And of course, into this mix, next please, turns up David Kuhn. David, who's a former ALP national president, he's now a consultant, seeing some opportunities with the election of Bob Hawke, engages closely with Valery Ivanov to exploit some business opportunities. But what he doesn't realise is when Valery Ivanov asks him, next please, to be discreet, it actually puts him in a cloud, and that then generates interest. Bob Hawke gets involved. Harvey Barnett spoke directly to Bob Hawke as the new Prime Minister. He wasn't wanting to talk to my great Chancellor, Gareth Evans, because Gareth had a reputation as a civil libertarian. He'd been quite critical of ASIO while he was in the opposition. And so Harvey just was not comfortable talking with him, so he went to the Prime Minister thinking that that would work out and that the Prime Minister would say, yeah, OK, give me more details, let's have another briefing in a few days' time. But of course Bob Hawke wants to act right then and there, and this actually catches Harvey Barnett off guard, and of course it then starts to unravel because he's not prepared for the media spotlight that follows. Next, please. Of course, key to this is what happens with Mick Young, Bob Hawke's close confidant, who was asked to resign after breaching cabinet confidence regarding Ivanov's expulsion. Hawke claims in the interview we conducted for the book that this was the hardest thing I ever had to do in politics. And it was a very difficult time for the Labor Party, for Bob Hawke. But what he did, and this was something that followed up on what had been promised prior to the election, the Labor Party had commissioned the Royal Commission on Intelligence and Security. They wanted to follow up to see how well the Fraser government had implemented it. So they were thinking about commissioning a follow-on Royal Commission anyway, but this precipitated that action. So Hawke commissions Hope again to conduct a Royal Commission on Australia's security intelligence agencies, and that proceeds there on. Next, please. And of course, as part of that, it's a media feeding frenzy. The Royal Commission on Australia's Security Intelligence Agencies, or RCASIA, thrust ASIO very much into the public spotlight with nightly television coverage and frequent cartoons. David Pryor particularly did some good ones that were in the Canberra Times. And of course, while it was pretty darn funny to read these cartoons, you know, here's one. Could you speak up, please? You know, it was quite amusing, but for ASIO, it was quite traumatic. And for Harvey Barnett, this old Cold War warrior who's very much a secretive operator, to be in the public limelight all the time was very confronting. Next, please. And of course, there was some very significant sensitive source protection issues because. Some of the sources that were revealing information were people that ASIO was obliged to protect, people whose lives could potentially be put on the line if their name was exposed, if the details were exposed. So ASIO had a legal obligation, a duty of care as well, to protect people from exposure in the media. But this was then seen as some kind of, you know, subterfuge by ASIO, a bit of playing with the audience and maybe feeding conspiracy theories, whereas What we see is that, as with Kuhn, people and their careers could and did suffer from exposure through this kind of open scrutiny in the Royal Commission process. Next, please. Now, Lev Koshliakov was the KGB resident at the time. He was actually quite furious with Valery Ivanov for going too far, too soon, with David Kuhn. He was in Australia for 7 years and he was considered one of the most dangerous KGB officers. Next, please. Ever posted to Australia. So we see there, I've just given you a taste of the counter-espionage story. There's many others in the book that you can explore in more detail. But do you get a flavour there of that? Now to look at the question of relocation and reform. Now, ASIO had been steeped in, you know, it's what they call the gnomes of Melbourne. It had been in Melbourne from 1949, when much of the Commonwealth government administration, the bureaucracy, was still in Melbourne. Over the subsequent two decades, it had moved largely to Canberra. ASIO had stuck in Melbourne. And what became very clear was that there was a need for ASIO to relocate, to be more accountable and more responsive to government by being in Canberra. And the man to do it was Alan Wrigley. This man was a take-no-prisoners director general. He had a reputation in defence that was, depending on who you ask, it was toxic, it was all gallant. But he was the man to make ASIO relocate, and it did. He had high aspirations in defence, and was reluctant to go there because he thought he was going to be the next Secretary of Defence. But he approached the task with determination and vigour. Now, ASIO did relocate in late 1986. It brought ASIO closer, more responsive to government priorities and practices. And we see there ASIO emerge into what is probably the modern era of ASIO history. Next, please, as it adjusted. Of course, this happened just before the end of the Cold War, and the fall of the Berlin Wall on the 9th of November 1989 really was kind of the point at which, the inflection point at which we end the volume. But there's a story subsequently, next please, Anne, that is one that was festering in the background, next please. And that was the question of penetration. And what we see is that KGB officers were, in fact, able to recruit and run agents in Australia for many years. There'd been suspicions of this since many years before, and we talked about this in volumes 1 and 2, the hints and the suggestions that perhaps ASIO was penetrated. After all, the Brits and the Americans had very, very publicly been penetrated and exposed and humiliated over their experience with moles. Surely ASIO was as well. The chapter called Looking for Moles follows ASIO's own investigations into persistent allegations of penetration by Soviet moles. Next, please. And, of course, the key guy here, Garonti Pavlovich Lazovic, is a key KGB officer in Canberra in 71-77. He was awarded a medal for an intelligence recruitment while he was stationed in Australia. This medal was a high award given for a significant recruitment. This is the man who Harvey Barnett almost asked the government, the Whitlam government, to have removed, but he didn't, thinking that it would be too politically sensitive. And in hindsight, it's arguably a great shame that that didn't happen. Ladies and gentlemen, I have given you a very quick surface scan of the history of ASIO Volume 3 in the context of the three-volume history. It is, I believe, a very significant reflection on Australia through the prism of ASIO. It is from unfettered access to the files, the Professor Horner, David Horner, myself and Rhys Crawley, we wrote this from the unredacted files. So there was no black marks indicating names or operation details removed. This was from the originals, still musty smelling files. What we wrote, the penultimate version of it, was in fact top secret. And we then went through the process of what I like to call pixelating out some of the sensitive details. And we had a lot of debate about what could be included, what could not be included, and how we would go about writing it. And, of course, what we ended up with in the end result is about 92% of what we submitted in that penultimate draft staying in the manuscript. So we're pretty happy that that happened, although it took quite a lot of debate and, thankfully, support from the Director General to see that through. So, Jared, thank you very much for that, and I'm happy to entertain.
Just before I... Did you have to have a security clearance?
I did, indeed.
Great. Yeah. So thanks to John Blackman for the presentation. We come to questions and discussion. Janet Grundy's got copies of The Secret Cold War, The Official History of ASIO, 1975-89, and plus a couple of copies of Volume 2 and Volume 1 outside, and I'm sure John Blaxland will be happy to sign Volume 2 and, of course, Volume 3. So we come to question and discussion. I mean, there are many questions, but perhaps you might just fill us in, because in David Horner's Volume 1, not so much in your Volume 2, but in your Volume 3, there's a very heavy concentration on the Soviet Union's interest in Australia. So the question is, at that stage, we're a relatively small country, an influential country, but not as significant perhaps as we are now. So why is the Soviet Union focused so much on Australia? What have we got here that they want there?
Well, thank you for the question, Jared. It's a very important question. And what we see is that there is, in many circles, there's a lack of an appreciation for how important Australia has become in the Five Eyes network, if you like. The anglospheric intelligence connections between the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia and New Zealand that emerges from the Second World War. Those arrangements, those intelligence arrangements, become incredibly intimate during that period, and they endure after the Second World War. And in fact, as the Cold War sets in, they are reburnished and expanded. And one of the things that happens in Australia is that where Australia gets many of the reports from the Brits and the Americans, and to a Soviet intelligence officer, Australia seemed like an easy backdoor to the Five Eyes, because there was a pretty relaxed approach to security in Australia. As much as ASIO officers might want to actually be vigilant and be that fourth arm of defence holding the fort, if you like, across government, in parliament, in various other circles, they were pretty cavalier about security. They just didn't see it as all that credible, even though the Petrov defection, you would have thought, would have made that clear. But because of the politics being so toxic and so divisive, there wasn't consensus over this question of security and of the need for vigilance. Now, of course, Australia had the weapons research establishment. We were involved in nuclear atomic testing in the 50s, and thereafter involved in some high technology collaboration with the Brits and then subsequently with the Americans. Of course, also from 1969 onwards, Australia is host to the joint defence facilities at Pine Gap and in Narunga. And these are you know, what the late Professor Desmond Ball called the strategic essence of the relationship. There's good reason for the Soviet to want to know what's happening in Australia and use that access to access sensitive information that's useful to the Soviet cause. And that's effectively why Australia was considered such an important target. And unfortunately, they were actually quite successful. They had successful, fairly high-level penetration of ASIO and the intelligence community and many operations. This is one of the interesting things about the espionage story. Looking at the Soviet Union's efforts in Australia, Australia's Security Intelligence Organisation was actually getting better at its job as time progressed. They're becoming more professional, they're introducing training regimes, they're recruiting more higher educated people, and it's a growing organisation with more skills, more capability, more refined processes, and yet repeatedly operations against the Soviets go to ground. And of course, that's not immediately apparent as to why that would be up front, and it's only after the end of the Cold War that this becomes very clear with the release of the Mitrokhin archives and some details in there that actually provides material that enables ASIO and the investigations that happen subsequently to triangulate and identify. And of course, the problem is that that's actually post-1989. So I was writing with Rhys, my colleague, we were writing about the period from the material we had access to stuff from afterwards that was relevant to this period, but we were largely constrained to operating with the information from that era. And that was a period when it was not at all clear what was going on, exactly how ASIO was being compromised. There was a sense it was being compromised, but it wasn't all that clear. And it's only in hindsight that it became clear.
Mm. So do you have your theories about who the Australian spies were? They're not in the book, but do you have your theories?
It's a trick question because I'm not in a position to talk in detail about revelations that were made after 1989, but there were very clear revelations.
Lindsay?
You spoke about high-level penetration, but in the same way the British and the Americans actually lost people to the other side, had defections, did ASIO or ASIS ever lose anyone who defected to the other side, or whatever the other side might have been?
There's in volume two, there's an interesting couple of stories about people working in that space, but not directly. No, what we see is there's a couple of direct defections to Australia, particularly from Soviet bloc representatives, but not from the Soviets themselves, because after the Petrov defection in the mid 1950s, the approach the Soviets take is very different, much more guarded, much more circumspect in their approach to engaging in Australia, because they once bitten, twice shy. But in terms of Australia, actually anyone defecting to the Soviets, I don't record anybody doing that in the book.
And let me go, Robin. Yeah.
The period when ASIO was not terribly sophisticated through in the 60s, 50s, whatever, a lot of that period Labor wasn't in government.
Mm.
To what extent was the more mature attitude in Labor in later years due to the fact that they finally got into government, made an awful mess of it under Whitlam, and then in the subsequent Hawke and Keating years finally realised the importance, and that's when ASIO really began to become more sophisticated?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Anne. It's interesting, you know, because even Lionel Murphy himself, when he's Attorney General, it doesn't take him long, particularly after the Murphy raid, for him to realise that, in fact, this is an organisation that's actually